Hi there, welcome to Sound Healing Radio. This is David Gibson, and our show today is on sound for children. And it's with our guest today is Elizabeth Gramsch. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning, David.
Morning. Actually, they'll be listening in the afternoon. We're recording this. We're recording this earlier. It's early for both of us a little bit. So our intention is that we may have sound for all children as they're growing up, exactly what they need to be healthy and happy for their entire life. That's our intention for this show. Before we get started, though, I want to tell you about some things happening at the school. Our next semester at the Institute is starting on September 6th. We've got the Sound Healing Certificate Program, which is 3 nights a week, Monday through Wednesday nights, and some weekends. And it's all about how sound affects you physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. We've got about a dozen instructors, so you get a full perspective on how sound affects you and how you can use sound. And what's really cool at the Institute is we have a large sound healing store with all types of bowls and instruments and technologies, and all the students get to use all of this equipment during the classes, especially when we're practicing on each other. So you get to learn what tools resonate with you so that you can really tune into it. And that's a really big advantage at our school, not to mention a bunch of other things. We also have a therapy room that the students get to work in, and we also have the Sound Healing Research Foundation. So that's starting, that's the certificate program that goes to December, and that's the first semester of the associate degree program. So you can continue into that, and there you become a master at sound healing. We also do a lot of research. We have people doing a lot of treatments on each other, and it's also, since it's a Sound and Consciousness Institute, we also talk about different modalities for consciousness and how to use sound for healing, but also for raising consciousness and really getting us to the next level. It's really a profound program. And we also have that program online as well. And Elizabeth is actually one of our instructors there, and we'll be talking about that a bit. And the online program, it works really well. You know, if you can't make it out, it's not a bad option, because we've got live instructors, or you could do it by video. And we do healings on each other. You get to practice on friends and family. And we do toning and chanting over WebEx, which is kind of like Skype. And it works really well. And that starts about every 2 weeks. We have ongoing enrollment. And that's the next start time is August 30th, which is, I guess, just this Tuesday. And so then we do have the associate degree in online as well, so you can continue into the associate degree. We also have the audio recording classes. We teach how to record, mix, and produce, and how to make music and recordings that touch people in a much deeper way using very interesting sound techniques. So we use Pro Tools, but if you're into any other programs, we can teach you about that program as well, because the techniques we teach go across all programs. That program starts September 7th at the Institute, and then it's online as well. And it works really well online, because you can see our screen, you can hear what I'm mixing, and we can also check your projects as well. And that starts, I think it starts like around September 7th as well, online. And so if you're interested in the classes, you can go to soundhealingcenter.com or give me a call at 415-777-2486, or email me at david@soundhealingcenter.com. Also, we do have therapies we do. We can find your soul note, where we can bring you to peace online or at the institute. We also have voice analysis where we can find what's wrong with you, what notes are missing in your system, and give you a CD in both cases so you can be resonated into health and bliss. Health and bliss, that's kind of the deal. We also have all types of other treatments at the institute where we do sound on the massage table. We also do a full combo treatment with voice and bowls and sound table. And then we got the store. We got a full range of technologies, including the most amazing thing is the sound table and the sound lounge. The therapy center, you can find at soundtherapycenter.com. The store you can find at soundoflove.com, although you can find everything at soundhealingcenter.com. But the big thing we have coming up is our Sound Healing Conference. This is our sixth one, and this one is out in the Headlands, which is a national park just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. And it's a beautiful area. Oh my God, there's so many animals out here. There's deer. And God, just last week, I was going through a little bit of emotional stuff. And this owl showed up 5 days in a row in front of my house. And then at 5 a.m, I woke up and I was feeling a little sad. And so I started making some sound to actually resonate this sadness. And this owl was at my window hooting after I started making the sound. Often when you make sound, they would go away. He came to me when I started making the sound. Oh my God. And my house is one block from where the conference is, where we're doing the workshop. And the beach is like less than 5 minute walk away. It's a beautiful place. There's lodging there for $30 a night, which is shared rooms, or you can get your own room. And there's food, there's going to be music throughout the day, sound healing music, a lot of beautiful vocals and crystal bowls and Tibetan bowls and gongs. And then there's all the workshops. We've got two rooms with speakers going. We have Ellen Amanis, who is the main researcher, or not researcher, actually the main person that's been checking out research in the field. She did a whole movie called The Power of Music and a book called The Power of Music. And it was on public television. And so she's really got all the main research, very definitive research from the field, and she'll be talking about that. We've got a full range of speakers that go from very scientific to very, maybe woo-woo, very esoteric, very profoundly, experientially effective. So you can find all the information for the conference at GlobeSoundHealingConference.com, GlobeSoundHealingConference.com, and there's still a prepay early bird discount until September 1st. You can also call us at 415-777-2486 or email me if you have any questions. And one of our main presenters is Elizabeth that we have here right now. Elizabeth is going to be talking about, let me pull it up. I don't have it up here. Elizabeth has been teaching at the Institute online for quite a few years, and she teaches a couple of things. She's taught acupressure, so you can learn about all the acupuncture points for tuning forks. She's also taught all about tomatis, and I'll have her tell more, but I'll tell you what I know about tomatis. Tomatis is one of the main researchers on the ear and on learning disabilities that come from problems with hearing, especially for children, but also for adults. And it gets actually very detailed into the way the ear works, and even the way the muscles and also the bone conduction through the head, and a full range of things. And there's all these different programs that have spun off from his teaching or from his research. And there's one is the listening program. The listening program helps. This is what I know, but Elizabeth will get into it in more detail. Listening program is a program that mostly exercises the stapedius muscle in the ear. And the stapedius muscle is a muscle that moves really fast, and if it gets sluggish, it can cause learning disabilities, and even some people say it's related to autism as well. So there's other programs that now have spun off since the FDA got a little feisty about that. And Elizabeth is, she's been studying sound and music and movement her whole life. She draws from 20 years of experience with Tomatis' work, listening programs, and teaching prenatal parenting and early childhood music and movement classes. And after a deeply transformational experience with the Tomatis method, she pursued a self-designed master's in human development to find out how it worked. She's traveled the country learning about language acquisition, auditory processing, psychophysiology of listening, prenatal listening, developmental movement and listening, and she interned at several Tomatis centers for firsthand experience, where she experienced the dramatic impact of sonic birth. She's also, oh my gosh, she's co-author of the book Body, Mind, and Voice: Foundations of Voice Education. Oh my God, I can't believe I don't have that book. And contributes chapters on prenatal and early childhood development. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you, David. That was lovely.
Yeah. You know, I think, oh my God, there's so much that you do. To put things in context, the one thing that we're really excited about right now is we've got a large grant to actually create a whole sound healing curriculum within Montessori schools that Elizabeth has been helping us with. We've been interviewing all of our instructors, and we've got over 250 exercises now that we'll start implementing them into two Montessori schools in the Bay Area here, starting in just 2 weeks, actually. And then we're going to implement more and more. We're going to get feedback from the instructors and from the children. We're going to be shooting video. We're going to refine it over the next year. And then we're planning on presenting at the Montessori Conference in July in Prague next year. We're going to be presenting our findings. And then we're going to set up an association to help bring this curriculum into private schools and public schools. We're going to be setting guidelines. We're going to be talking with administrators. We've already got a large number of administrators that have shown up and called us over the last couple of months, that especially for private schools, that are really excited about bringing this, at least parts of this curriculum, into the private schools. And so what we've been doing is really trying to figure out precisely, what we can do with sound and music at the different age levels. Because in the Montessori school, they start at 3 months. So we've got things we exercises we do from 3 months to 18 months, 18 months to 3 years, 3 to 6, and then 6 to 12, and 12 to 18. So, oh my God. And what's happened, I'm just so excited because when we presented all of these exercises to our staff, who came up with, most of them, we presented the whole thing. I just got this overwhelming feeling that I just wanted to just cry and cry and cry, just imagining children growing up doing toning and sound and using sound to release their stuck emotions and making the sound of how they feel and having all these techniques to deal with different disabilities or problems that happen with birth. And it's just like, I just saw this the world changing drastically with this. So with that, tell us about yourself. I guess the best thing to talk about is to ask you, because there's so many different things, is what is it that you're most excited about as far as sound for children?
I'm really excited about the Montessori project because I believe that what you are talking about with the kids needing all this sound healing in childhood is where I've been going most of my life. The listening programs have been wonderful, but if we can provide an enriched environment and if they can be empowered to do this themselves, I feel it has a much more lasting impact. And in fact, that's more true to Dr. Tomatis's work. He believed that the listening electronic ear that he developed was just to get them started, and that they were to follow up with a full year and continued year after year boosts and ongoing vocal work and movement to maintain their optimal listening. And I'm concerned today that some of the listening programs are being used as sort of a Band-Aid and not being consistently developed or helping people to consistently develop their listening skills.
Tell us what the electronic ear is and the listening program so we know.
Well, Dr. Tomatis was the first person to pioneer an electronic music program where he psychoacoustically modified the music to help people develop proper listening skills. He distinguishes hearing from listening. Most kids only get a hearing screening right now, which is very rudimentary and basic, and it doesn't test how their listening is. That would be like saying if somebody was blind or not blind, but if they can't focus on the board, we know they need glasses. It's about a focusing issue. And so in the ear, listening is a focusing mechanism. And it's a lifelong journey to maintain our ability to tune in and to tune out, to protect our hearing from sounds that are, too much for our bodies and our minds to handle, and to expand our consciousness using sounds that are enriching. And so the electronic ear was developed primarily for singers and foreign language accent modification, and people in the arts originally, because that's where he was, his early clients were. And the work that he did with the electronic ear with children came much, much later, only because there was some anecdotal evidence that this was beneficial to them. So it was quite a surprise to him. So he worked with some well-known singers like Enrique Caruso, and Caruso told him that he could do this kind of clicking that would improve his singing. And first you need to understand that Tomatis' first law is that the ear and the voice have a cybernetic loop, and that the first law states that the ear can the voice can only produce the sounds which the ear can hear. And so that's where vocal analysis is coming into play, that it tells you what you are actually listening to or hearing. I think they say hearing, but listening is more what they're accurate, more accurate. And so Enrique was telling them, oh, I've got this clicking thing that I do that helps me bring back some of these frequencies. And so Tomatis worked with him pretty intensively, and he developed what was then proprietary mechanism for what he called gating. It was his first psychoacoustic modification, and he decided that he could put it into an electronic ear and that other people could benefit from this gating mechanism. Since Tomatis has passed away, there's been a huge explosion in neuroscience, and what we have now is a little bit better understanding of how the auditory pathways work. So there's two pathways, one coming in, one going out, and along that pathway, the nervous system excites or inhibits the sounds running along it. And when it's inhibiting, there's a protection mechanism going on. It says, no, we're not going to move you along the pathway up to the higher part of the brain. This is either a physical or an emotional threat, so we're just going to keep you down here. And if that continues for a long period of time and it increases over longer ranges of frequencies, two things start to happen. One is you don't get the stimulation in the higher part of the brain for those frequencies, and so you become a little bit limited. You can develop what's called a scotoma in your auditory, audiogram. And those little scotomas make it impossible for you to perceive all of that. So you're sort of seeing a picture with a bunch of holes in it. And you're pretty unaware of it usually, because we don't talk about listening in our culture in ways that that are similar to vision. We just don't really see listening, so we have a hard time understanding listening. And the other thing that happens is it's very fatiguing on the body to continue to have these protective mechanisms in place for all of these frequencies. And that's a stress state. And so these low-level stress states kind of accumulate over time, and we start seeing an inhibition in development in children.
What are the main ways you detect it?
Well, it depends on the age. Mm-hmm. When I was working at the hospital, I developed my own observational skills to detect what was going on with babies. I furthered that with developmental movement. I work with reflexes with babies. Because we can't really do a hearing test, that requires them to respond and say, yes, I hear that sound, or no, I don't hear that sound. Mm-hmm. There's sort of this window between 1 to 3, age 3, where it's very hard to get testing. And even when we're testing them for pre-K or for kindergarten readiness, it's hard to figure out if they're understanding that they raise their hand when they hear a sound. It depends on the person who's giving the test. You know, we have a lot of that syndrome where the kid thinks there's supposed to be a sound, so they'll raise their hand, just because they assume something's coming, but did they actually hear it? And that's where I think if Tomatis was still around, he probably would have moved more, and he was moving more towards vocal analysis, because that can show some frequency loss. As you know, we've done with the Institute. So with young kids, vocal analysis can be helpful. But really, when they're down into that early, early age, which is where I've been contributing more to the Montessori Project, there's a limitation in how we can assess what's going on with their listening by self-report.
But you see it in their movement, you say, sometimes.
Yeah. So they can't report it to us, so we need to be great observers of how they move, mm-hmm. and how they're developing and how they're responding. And it's been really exciting to contribute to the project and say, these environments can be overstimulating, and these are the ways that the babies can let us know that that's too much. Or too little stimulation. And they need to learn how to self-regulate that stimulation for their own systems to be able to attend. If they start to inhibit, for instance, if you have a baby that's in an environment that's not, it's overstimulating for them, and they can't get away from it, and they can't communicate to anybody to help them get away from it, they'll start developing inhibition. They'll start protecting themselves internally to that. Mm-hmm. And so they'll start inhibiting along that pathway. And once those pathways start inhibiting, they're not as easy to open as their eyelids. Ears take a little bit more work and a lot more patience and effort to open that pathway again. It's far more complex and far more rich than our visual system.
One thing you'd mentioned before is, you'd said that sometimes they just go to sleep, and that's a sign is when they're overstimulated.
Yes.
And sometimes I remember you saying that it's like some people think, ah, that they're we've now put them to sleep, when really they're like I can't handle it anymore.
Yeah, this is where attachment research comes into play, because Dr. John Bowlby talks about attachment, and he said it's very important for a child to get to develop an attachment to one primary caregiver, and that one primary caregiver be responsive to them and recognize their signs. Mm-hmm. And if their sign is that they fall asleep when they're overstimulated, that person needs to respond appropriately and bring them to a quiet area.
Mm, nice. What other things do you observe that, because I know you're kind of a master at the observation, what are some subtle signs that you observe that let you know something is going on for the young ones?
Well, I have a couple ideas on that one that I can share over the line. The first thing I observe is whether they're rolling to the left and to the right equally, mm-hmm. From back to front and front to back. Mm-hmm. This is really important because they need to develop the right side and the left side independently. And the rolling is actually activated by listening. Hmm. Their awareness of something to the side, let's say they're on their back and they hear something off to the right, they turn their head to look. So they listen and then they look. And then if that thing is enticing to them, a toy or something, they reach with that hand. If that particular toy is out of reach, then they need to extend themselves and they can roll. They learn to roll to extend their reach to get that thing that they want. Okay. It's really important, by the way, to let kids reach and extend themselves instead of constantly giving them the toys if they're looking for something, because they need to develop that rolling. So that's an important piece to develop their listening skills. Once they've developed those two sides independently, they can then go on to develop symmetry. So the asymmetry comes first. Then they develop symmetry. In different language, when the ears are working separately, it's be like mono radio. You know, it's not working together. When they're working together, it's more like stereo, mm-hmm. what they call binaural listening. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of kids with ADD and other learning challenges are still running in mono. They're not listening binaurally. And it comes right down to those early movements where they didn't fully develop both sides equally. And so when they get to the point where they try to fuse the two halves together into a symmetrical or 3D experience of sound, one side is weaker than the other, and they're a little off kilter. And they often don't make it to that binaural listening.
So it sounds like the most noticeable thing is if you shake a rattle or any sound off to one side and they don't turn towards that. I mean, is that kind of the most basic thing you're looking for there?
Yeah, absolutely. First, mm-hmm. I have to really get to know my environment. I need to know what's going on in the sound in my room. I need to know if there's any other distractions. Because their brain is not developed fully there, you have to make sure they're not wet, they're not hungry, they're not tired. You know, mm-hmm. basic needs need to be met. So it usually takes me about 6 weeks, 5-6 weeks before I can see that situation you're talking about and make sure that it's not some kind of environmental influence on that. Mm-hmm. But I get to know them pretty well, and after 5 or 6 weeks, then I can say, okay, this has been consistent, and it's not about the environment. This is something going on within them.
Got it.
And that's where we step back, and I say, how was the birth?
So now, once you got an assessment, or what are some of the things you can do as far as treatments?
I work with parents, and I teach them how to work with their babies on the floor. It's not a new concept. Stanley Greenspan does the floor time, but my focus is a little bit different. I work right when the babies are developing the movements that they need to be using. And I always use music and movement with the parents to make it fun and engaging and to help them to feel confident singing with their babies and playing games with them. It's really important that their heart be engaged in a playful way and in a joyful way, because a lot of times when babies wind up in programs, they wind up with a kind of a fix-it feel to it. And that fix-it is kind of a stressor for parents. So I kind of like to bring them in and make this all about play. Mm-hmm. And then I show them how we can support that movement. For instance, I worked with a severe case. I had a little guy who was a fail to thrive. Parents were about 3 weeks away from having baby taken from them and institutionalized to try to save the baby. Yeah. And he had such a traumatic prenatal experience and birth experience that he couldn't even reach for food. At 6 months, he wasn't reaching at all, and low muscle tone. And I started with food. We had to go through all kinds of food and say, what does he smell? What does he like? And I could just watch him, you know, until he liked the food. And then I got it so he would reach for the food, you know. So I use what I can and get parents to help them develop these movements and give them home activities to do that.
Wow. So you're using rhythm. I mean, I know some of the things that we're going to be incorporating that you had mentioned is like doing rhythms, tapping rhythms on the feet or on the body.
Yeah.
I mean, also you can actually kind of dance with the babies. There's mm-hmm. you know, we're going to be doing toning for the young ones at the Montessori school, where we're doing
right.
just different vowels and different rhythms with the vowels. We're doing high and low notes as well to start. So one thing you said that was really interesting is that the babies actually up until one actually like more complexity. So they might actually like something like Mozart or Beethoven. It's almost like they're light beings, you know, until they're one. When they get to round one, then it's more all about bonding at that point. Is that kind of true?
It is, but I think the age is like 4 months. There's something that happens at 4 months called the completion of a brain growth spurt. It's a cycle of brain development that we all go through throughout life. The baby's first completion of a brain growth spurt happens at the birth, and the second one happens at 4 months and then 8 months, et cetera. And what I found was actually the newborns, birth to four, because they're not moving, they're in a very receptive phase. So they're receiving, you know, they're nursing, and they're just really, some people call it the fourth trimester. They're really just trying to absorb their environment. And I find that that's where they really want the complexity,
mm-hmm.
Because they're little sponges. And at 4 months, they develop a whole new set of capabilities, and they start interacting more. And there's still, you know, there's a crossover always. There's still some complexity that they're really engaged with. But by 6 months, they're moving and shaking, and they want more repetition. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, complexity is wonderful for them. They're soaking it all up. And lots of complex rhythms, interdependent rhythms and melodies are great. And then when they start developing a little bit more movement capability, I use simple songs and I change the words and simple rhythms to help them organize their nervous system.
Cool.
And so you use entrainment to help them develop these movements. And that's where the rhythm comes in that you were talking about. When I work with parents, rhythm is a really important component. Because it not only helps calm the nervous system, it helps organize development, and it helps entrain them to these movement patterns that we really need them to develop.
As far as the rhythms, are there? Should the rhythms be really simple?
Yes, I usually like to introduce duple and triple. Mm-hmm. Babies learn by contrast. So I do music in minor and major, high and low, you know, duple and triple. And so when they have parallel tracks of duple and triple experiences of simple things like a cha-cha rhythm and a waltz rhythm.
Uh-huh. Dum, bum,
you know,
bum, bum, and dun, dun,
bum,
dun.
Bum, bum, ba, ba, bum, 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 or da, 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 da.
Mm-hmm. And you like to switch yeah. back and forth between those rhythms? Is that what you're saying?
I usually stick with one rhythm in a session
mm-hmm.
and have them do that. And then the next session, I would go to the triple rhythm one session, duple rhythm another session, and let them experience that. When they're older, I switch back, frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the activities can go back and forth between duple and triple. But in that first 4 months, 4 to 6 months, I would keep it separate.
And so it's really all about consistency and stability of
yes.
rhythm, really, really just creating so that their nervous system can synchronize to something stable,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't put the rhythm on the body in the first year. I only put the steady beat.
Oh, okay.
Steady beat competency is something that Phyllis Weikert has done a lot of research on. And kids who don't have steady beat competency are consistently low performers in school.
Hmm.
Actually, the numbers are shocking, David. In the 80s, she found that only 50 or 60% of kids had steady beat competency, and she was horrified. So she repeated it in the 90s, and it dropped to 30 or 40%. She did it again in the 2000s. Now, it's not published yet, but I heard through some of my music therapy friends that it's down to, like, in the 20s
so that's, of kids. So that means that they just can't play or move at or even sing or even think a steady rhythm?
Well, it means that the test is very simple. They just have to clap a steady beat for 1 minute.
Okay, cool. So a lot of it is, it sounds like it's going from playing steady beats to as soon as possible to getting them to actually do steady beats.
Yes. So when we're working with the babies, I put only steady beat into the body,
mm-hmm.
but through my voice or auditory pieces, I'll use duple, triple, simple meter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because that helps them develop the auditory cortex for their vocal control. But in the body, the steady beat is critical. And so when you tap the rattle or the sticks or just tap your hands on the bottom of their feet, it's always in a steady beat.
And then at what age about what age are they able to start doing some rhythm?
I start, again, vocalizing with them in a dialogue probably I can get them to do it pretty young, actually.
Yeah.
15 months.
Uh-huh.
Between 14 and 17 months, they've had that's their third brain growth cycle completion, and this new thing comes online. And what I do is I tap the foot, and I just say, may I put the bead on your feet? And then I say, ba, 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 ba. And they'll say it back, ba, 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 ba. And then I'll say, ba, 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 ba. And when they can do the ba-bas,
baby kirtan.
Then I can, oh, they're so cute. I mean, it is the sweetest thing you've ever seen to see these little kids doing their ba-bas. And by the way, that helps them feel safe and connected in an environment, the ba-bas.
Uh-huh.
I have a great story to share. I did this with my nephew, and my husband and I had him out at the Smithsonian, and it got very busy, and he was in a backpack on my husband's back, and he was probably only 2.5 or 3 years old, and we got separated in the crowd. And all of a sudden, I heard this little tiny voice saying, ba-ba. And I said, ba-ba. And he went, ba-ba-ba. And I said, ba-ba-ba. And then we played this game until he could see me again. And then he stayed calm and in a crowd of people. He didn't cry out. He wasn't afraid.
Wow.
We connected through voice.
Oh, that's so cool. So at what age do they start clapping rhythms?
I don't have them. Clapping is probably coming in around that 3.
Mm-hmm.
At age 3, lots of stuff comes on. Steady beat, they can tap on their knees. I like to do homologous movements first.
Mm-hmm.
Clapping puts them in the midline. That puts them right in symmetry. They can certainly clap before age 3, but to clap in a steady beat with some consistency, I would say, happens around 3.
And then actually maybe even one hand would be easier than clapping at first, huh? Just playing a,
right.
A drum.
I have them tap on their knees.
Uh-huh. Cool.
And then I have them tap their feet, and I have them tap their tummy and their toes and their nose. And, we do all their body parts.
So to get to jump to an older age now, this is what we're working on right now. We've got the kids as soon as two or three, we're having them, or I think it's around three, we actually start having them make the sound of how they're feeling. And then we have the teacher do it, and then so they're practicing, you know, just vocalization. They're already doing vowels and rhythms and stuff with their voice. We're doing a lot of call and response and things like that. And then where we're headed is at some point we want them to be able to make the sound not only of how they're feeling that they've been doing for many years, but also to be able to make the sound to be able to release stuck emotions. And so we're looking at what age that will be good. And this is what happened, is we realized that this could be really dangerous, especially if we start going into public and private schools. So the thought is, you know, we've got a kid that's either been traumatized or even worse, or not worse, is been told to never express their feelings, right? And so we do.
Right.
So we do this exercise, which we do in the classes right now at the school, to help release stuck emotions and be able to make the sound of how they're feeling and transform them. And then the problem is, they could go to the parents and go, you know, F you. You know, and then they get slapped, and then they get taken away. I mean, there's all types of potential problems when they start opening up, and if they don't have the communication skills to be able to do it. So what we're floating around is around 9 or 10 to start doing this. And the Montessori schools, though, if they've been doing this already, making sound of their emotions for years, that's really... it's going to be much easier. But when we just start, especially in public or private schools, there's a lot of potential for problems here. So what we're looking at is what age to start doing that, and what to do for like the 6 to 12 year olds in the meantime, so we don't get into deep therapy yet. That's a big one.
That is a big one.
What do you think?
And I have so many thoughts, they just crashed in my head. they made like Megillah. Okay.
I'll be quiet. let you open up.
You're absolutely right that it's not really up to us to decide, I don't think, when a child is ready to become conscious or when the conditions are not right. If they're not in a safe place to open up to that, it is very dangerous. This was a huge pushback in the listening programs as well. So the Tomatis program is probably the most effective program available. However, it will open you up in really big ways. And unless you are very, very ready and very conscious about this, it can be a backlash. And one of the problems that we had with this backlash was that kids who were hypersensitive to sound became more sensitive to sound sometimes. And when we looked into this, it turned out that it was they were not in an environment that encouraged or was able to support their new found listening, their new awareness and consciousness. And they actually went into more protection because they had the courage to open up and venture out and then got hurt again.
And then don't have the tools to deal with it.
Right. So this is where I feel that sound healing plays a more important role. When you have kids who are environments that are, or they're not quite ready. And I used to be more, I used to think it was more important that we just be wide open and be very conscious, and wasn't that the great end goal. And I had a little guy who taught me a lot about that. He was probably about 14 months when I tried a lot of things with him, and he was struggling with some of his movement patterns, but he was getting it, and he was progressing, and we worked together for about 6 months. And I said, I think he's ready now for a listening program. And I put the headphones on him, and he lit up like a Christmas tree, and he started doing all of these symmetrical movements that he was really struggling with, because sound can really energize the body to do some of these movements. There's a timing to bring that in. And then he looked right at me, and David, it was soul to soul, and he said, "Nope, I'm not going to do this," and he stopped.
Wow.
And I didn't understand
months.
It. Oh yeah, 14 months. He was doing an STNR bounce, and he just stopped, and it was just a nonverbal, crystal clear message to me, "I'm not doing this." And I backed off, and I didn't see the family for quite a while. And about fast forward, he came back to me when he was 6. So that must have been, like 4 or 5 years later. And I found out there was all kinds of family traumas coming in to play. There was all kinds of stuff that, would have been too much for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also got his parents to help support him in other ways. He developed some other abilities to listen. So where you shut one door, you open another. This is like someone who's blind that develops this huge capacity to do something else, in their sensory realm. So I stopped seeing those as shut doors, and I started seeing it as just, well, that's a door that he wants to shut because he wants to go this way and develop mm-hmm. more in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
And he turns out to be a cellist.
Wow.
And he
Whoa.
Put that cello between his legs, and that low vibration Whoa. That he needed, he got his parents to get him involved in cello, and he's phenomenal. He was in Suzuki at age 4.
Whoa.
This is what he wanted. This was his sound healing. So the listening program wasn't right for him.
Uh-huh.
The movements weren't right for him at that time because big things were happening in the family for a couple of years, and he knew he couldn't open up. He couldn't tell me that because he was only 14 months, but uh-huh. I just look back on it. And then he started struggling in school, is why they came back to me when he was 6.
Uh-huh.
And then we did the listening program, and he was great. And he came in Asperger's on the tests, and we worked with him for 3 years, and I just found out that he had that all removed. He has no diagnosis anymore.
Wow. So the listening program,
mainstream.
My understanding of the listening program is it takes classical music and slowly rolls off the low frequencies until it's just the high frequencies and then rolls them back in. But it's also got gating going on, which is kind of the tics which activate the stapedius muscle. Is that right?
Yeah, that's not the listening program. That's the Tomatis method.
Oh, okay. What's the listening program then?
The listening program also has psychoacoustically modified music, but the goal for them has been different. Because they saw what was happening with the Tomatis method, that was such an intense program, and the changes happened so quickly, they changed their focus to being a 15 minutes a day stretched out over 10 months,
mm-hmm.
and or even longer. And their idea is to educate more people about the sound fitness and trying to incorporate listening development and skills into families. And so they really wanted to educate people to do that. Their psychoacoustic modifications on the music do have some focus on low frequency, mid frequency, high frequency, etc., but they don't do the same kind of filtering that Tomatis does.
Uh-huh.
There's no bandpass filtering.
Uh-huh.
And they do have some aspects of gating, but they don't do it electronically. They do it through the composition. They actually write the music to have like a sudden low to high, a bass to a violin, back and forth. So they create it organically in the music. And so they're very different programs that use similar concepts. They use sound localization as well, so that you can develop the surround sound that the kids are really missing right now.
Uh-huh.
Because they live in boxes, David.
So
they don't go out into nature,
So they're using 3D sound processors to have the sounds actually not just move left and right, but around the room with the headphones?
Yeah, the listening program partnered with Dolby, and they mm-hmm. have a special surround sound system that they put into their program. Yeah.
Cool. What age is that good for starting at? Or I guess it totally depends on what's going on.
But. Yeah, because the listening program is less intense, But what it makes that lacks in intensity, it makes up for in depth. You know, it's kind mm-hmm. of the tortoise versus the hare, you know. Mm-hmm. It is safer to use with younger kids, I feel, especially for people who aren't able to, you know, the timing of things, like when to start something, and the cost, actually. I mean, there are some real factors here for kids. Uh-huh. So they meet the needs of a lot of families, and they use similar concepts from the Tomatis method, but they don't use all of the concepts.
Uh-huh.
They don't use the sonic birth in the same way. They don't climb the mountain in the same way uh-huh. that Dr. Tomatis did it. And they certainly don't filter and use frequencies all the way up to that 8,000 hertz that Dr. Tomatis did. It's that filtering out up to 8,000 hertz that creates the what Tomatis believed to be the intrauterine experience of listening.
Uh-huh.
And so some of the sonic birth things I'm going to be talking about at the conference are really fairly specific to Dr. Tomatis's work and not some of the other listening programs.
Mm-hmm. What else will you be talking about at the conference?
I'd like to talk about how important your knowledge of the birth is for those working with the babies.
How the birth went?
Yeah, how the mm-hmm. birth went. And specifically some birth interventions that the medical system has been using and they're not as tried and true. They haven't tested or done long-term studies on what they've been doing with these sound things, ultrasound, vibroacoustic stimulation test. These have long-term impacts on children that haven't been studied
mm-hmm.
fully. And I'm doing some more research on that currently. I've been following this for about 10 or 15 years when I worked with Dr. Verney, but this use of particularly the vibroacoustic stimulation test, it's changed a bit. They used to put a cord up through the cervix and screw it into the scalp of the baby.
Oof.
And they would put 130 decibels
whoa.
Into the scalp. And it would cause a stress response, which is movement, a moral reaction, a fight or flight movement in the body. And then they would say, well, the baby's fine. And they're quite aware that it distresses the baby. That's okay. They just feel that if the baby moves, then the baby's okay. But it accelerates heart rate. And when I crossed the aisle to the other departments at the university I was studying at and said, what would 130 decibels do to cerebral spinal fluid? They looked at me like I was crazy. Why would anybody do that, you know? I said, well, they're doing it over there to babies when they're born,
wow.
you know. So I'm going to bring in some of that information, and you need to be aware of that as a sound healer, where these babies are coming from, what they've already been exposed to before you get to them. They're not all sharing the same experience.
One of our students did a paper on sound healing for pregnant women, and
mm-hmm.
it was really excellent. She really checked out a lot of the research, and one of the main things I learned is that really loud sounds for pregnant women, it can be extremely dangerous.
Yes, it can actually cause kind of a, like what we talked about, an auditory scotoma,
mm-hmm.
where there's a inhibition in the auditory pathway, but in the womb, they're only listening to their bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually know, I've heard anecdotally a story about having actually kind of a bone impact, and like a traumatic, you know, impact to the bones of the baby from these kind of sounds.
Wow.
That the sound waves are so powerful that they're actually impacting the bone structure.
Wow.
And that definitely is a problem for these babies.
We're almost out of time. And oh my God, this is like so important, and there's so much information and so much to be researched and everything. You know, one thing I thought about when you were talking about the kid that actually ended up playing cello is,
mm-hmm.
you know, when that kid was saying, or baby was saying no, you know, it's like to give, mm-hmm. To have multiple options. So whether
yeah.
it's a crystal bowl or from a distance or any sound healing instrument or rhythm instrument, and the cool thing about all these sound healing instruments is the kids don't have to have a lot of skill to be able to play them.
Right.
compared to a lot of other instruments. So there's so much more, so much potential. I mean, it could be, I mean, there's all, if we had like a full array of different styles of music for different issues, mm-hmm. I mean, the potential here is so huge.
Well, and expressing yourself with an extension, you know, through an instrument is one thing, but I forgot to say one thing really quick is that mm-hmm. with the emotions, in the babies, it's very easy to close the neural loop on emotions if you mirror them. And one of the things I did when I was at the university is I was in a lab school and I was filmed for gender bias, which was a little uncomfortable, but this was a long time ago, and I learned a lot about my classes and my parents and myself. And we are comfortable with certain emotions and not with others, and that training begins very young. And what I changed after that process in my teaching was if the child, if the baby's mad, mirror anger to them, and it immediately closes the loop for them.
Which is a good thing. Closing the loop is
yes,
a good thing.
Yes, closing the loop is a good thing. Because in the beginning, the baby is closing loops with their environment, with their caregivers, with their people.
Mm-hmm.
And then they internalize that.
Mm-hmm.
And when they become older, they have that loop internally, and they're not so mm-hmm. dependent on the environment for mirroring them.
Right.
So if you really want to change the 6 to 12-year-old, which was a big question you asked me, mm-hmm. you work with the babies, and you help close those loops as much as you can before they get to that age.
Cool.
And
oh my
there
God.
We go.
Oh, my God. So if you like, you want to tell how people can get in contact with you?
Yes, you can email me at... egramsch@yahoo.com. You can go to my website at www.elizabethgramsch.com.
And how do you spell Gramsch?
G-R-A-M as in Mary, B as in boy, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, H.
Cool.
And yeah, feel free to email me with any questions.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, thank you, thank you, thank you for being on the show. And I really got what you're doing is such important work. It's amazing. There's so few people doing the type of thing you're doing, and to because there's like so much, and it's so important. It's just bizarre, actually.
Yeah, it's a little lonely out here, so I really appreciate that you've been giving me a forum to speak about it and appreciate the work.
Cool. Cool. Well, thank you so much for what you do. And again, we return to our intention,
mm-hmm.
and that is that every child gets exactly the sound they need to be healthy, happy, blissful, and exactly what they need for their highest good for the rest mm-hmm. of their life. So, hold that
thank you.
Energy for at least the rest of the evening, or maybe the whole week. Hold that intention. Oh, months, years, and lifetimes for the whole planet. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you, David.
Okay. Take care.